The grand finale of Earthcore is brought to you by the GFL Book 6 pre-order event on April 1st, 2019 at scottsigler.com. Get your pre-order in for the signed, numbered, limited edition hardcover of The Gangster, the sixth book in the sprawling Galactic Football League saga. Pre-order begins at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern on April 1st, 2019, and the event takes place at scottsigler.com. If you are hearing this after April 1st, 2019, you can visit scottsigler.com/thegangster and get your pre-order in there. Don't miss your chance for this limited edition hardcover, which will not be in stores. And now, on with the finale of Earthcore.
Welcome to the serialized audiobook, Earthcore. Written by New York Times bestselling novelist Scott Sigler. Narrated by Ray Porter. Produced by Steve Rickyberg. Earthcore is also available in print as an ebook and as a full-length audiobook. If you want the whole story without waiting, grab one of these formats from the links at scottsigler.com/earthcore.
Hello, junkies! Welcome to episode number 41, the last episode of Earthcore. A note on the GFL pre-order event for The Gangster, book 6 of the Galactic Football League series. If you have a coupon, because of the Alive promotion from a few years back, you need to know what email you used for that purchase, because your coupon for GFL book 6 is connected to that same email address. So when you pre-order GFL book 6 and you enter your email in the order form, make sure you use the same email that you used to order Alive way back when, because that is what your coupon is attached to. If you don't know what that email is, let us know at info@emptyset.com as soon as you can. Send us an email. We will try to track it down for you. If you don't have time to do that, just buy book 6. We will work it out with you after the fact. So, here we are with the finale of Earthcore. Next week and the week after on this podcast, we will have our traditional Q&A episode. There is still time for you to get your questions in. You can send those also to info@emptyset. A real girl will read your questions live. I will answer them live. Or send us an MP3 of you asking your succinct question. Don't ramble on for 60 seconds because we'll have to trim that. Send us your MP3. We will play it live, and I will answer it live. Yes, we'll do it live! So you get to hear your own voice on our podcast, and I will answer it. The deadline to get your question in for the Earthcore Q&A is April 3rd, noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. One last time, send your question to info@emptyset.com. Which brings us to the last episode of Earthcore. This book is the one that started it all for my career. I podcast the first version of Earthcore back in 2005, almost 15 years ago. Were you with me back then? If not, boy, am I glad you are here now. This book launched my career. It started my huge online following of people who are tuning every week to get their Earth crack, which is where the term junkies came from, people who are waiting for their weekly fix of moi. It gave me a big audience, and I was able to parlay that audience into selling Ancestor on Amazon, a paperback of Ancestor, which hit number one in horror and number one in sci-fi on April 1st, 2007, which is why April 1st is Sigler Ascension Day, which is why we're selling GFL Book 6 on April 1st. So Earthcore kicked it all off for me. I started podcasting when my agent told me it was a horrible idea. It would compromise audio rights. I did not have a book deal. I threw caution to the wind and thought, this is a way to reach people. And I think this book is going to really resonate if I can just get it in front of people. With the podcast, I was able to get it in people's ears. They started telling other people, and one thing led to another, and it gave me everything that I have now. This episode, episode 41, will be the last time Earthcore story content appears in this podcast ever. We do got the two Q&A episodes coming up, which are a ton of fun. Hope you guys check those out because they are a blast. But this brings to a close Earthcore as far as this podcast goes, and I'm a little verklempt. I am a little verklempt, but I hope you have enjoyed your time with me, Connell Kirkland, Veronica Reeves, O'Doyle, Libran, Angus, and the rest of the cast. I do hope you come back in the next 2 weeks for the Q&A episodes because they are a blast. I think you will enjoy them. You get a lot of insights into Siglerism and how things work, how the bread is made, so to speak. And after that, I hope you stay with us for The Reef, a brand new GFL novella that currently isn't available anywhere. It hasn't been out. We start that podcast in 3 weeks. So come on back and join us for that at the very, very least. Ladies and gentlemen, junkies of all ages, let me get you caught up on the story, and then we're going to say goodbye to Earth Core. Previously on Earth Core, Veronica Reeves has lowered the mysterious orb to the bottom of the shaft, and now the orb is about to fulfill its ancient purpose. The Roctopi will not be taken alive. Connell is trying to escape the tunnels. O'Doyle and Libran are farther up the Linus Highway. They are badly wounded and had just stripped Angus Cool of his cool suit so that Libran could continue on. Meanwhile, Sonny McGinnis watches Funeral Mountain from a safe distance. But he is about to learn that there is no such thing. Our story concludes next on Earth Core, episode number 41.
Chapter 34, 121,440 feet below the surface, 11 o'clock a.m. The orb shuddered once, then disappeared in a nova of light brighter than the sun. Shockwaves lashed out at supersonic speeds, disintegrating the countless support pillars in a billowing burst of evaporated stone. A great rumbling and shaking began as millions of tons of rock, now without support from below, began to settle into the newly created void. Devastating heat from the blast raced up the deep shaft, melting rock along the way. Within seconds, the blast erupted into the dense mass cavern, spurting upward like a geyser in an expanding cloud of destruction. The orb's cathedral room, which sat in the center of the immortal metal hull, sagged like cheap wax, collapsed in on itself, in seconds going from a magnificent technological monument to a white-hot sea of molten metal. Silver bugs erupted like popcorn, then melted in place to join the boiling pool of metal. Like a ring rippling from a pebble in a pond, the explosive heat reached out from the ship's center, melting the timeless vessel in a quickly expanding wave. The shockwaves also traveled downward, winning the battle between the irresistible force and the immovable object. Rock simply ceased to exist as star-like temperatures evaporated everything within reach, creating a huge bubble of superheated gas. The orb didn't punch a hole through the Earth's mantle. It didn't have to. The cold, calculated, precise science that once carved out the pillars had placed the shaft's bottom a geological hair's width from the swirling mantle. For millennia, the Earth's internal pressure pushed against the shaft floor, obeying the laws of physics and seeking the easiest way out. But the shaft floor's precise design had held just enough strength to keep that incalculable force at bay, just enough to keep things as they were meant to be. The orb, however, melted another half-mile's worth of crust, a calculation as fixed and precise as a surgeon's stroke. At the bottom of that newly created bubble of plasma, the Earth's pressure, so long held in check by the thinnest of margins, finally broke free. Magma rocketed upward with tidal wave force, pushed ever higher by the liquid core's grinding, pulsating pressures. The magma filled the new pocket and continued up the shaft, pushing the 10,000-degree gas bubble before it. 11:01 a.m. O'Doyle and Libran crawled on their bellies, urged on by the unmistakable smell of fresh outside air. The ground shuddered beneath them, pouring fuel on their desperate effort to escape the mountain. The low rock ceiling scraped at O'Doyle's back. He grunted as he worked his thick trunk through the narrow opening, jagged limestone tearing his cool suit to shreds. He wiggled past a pumpkin-shaped rock and continued on. 11:02 a.m. At the waterfall, the temperature soared 1,000 degrees. 2,000. More. The river instantly boiled to superheated steam. The roctopi clinging to the ancient, tentacled sculpture died quickly, the fluid in their bodies boiling, making them swell like water balloons before erupting with audible pops. 11:03 a.m. The ground beneath Connell shook and lurched, knocking him about so violently that he couldn't even stay on his hands and knees. He fell to his chest. Cracks raced up the tunnel walls like bolts of splitting lightning, the sound of grinding rock following like thunder. Thick, swirling storm clouds of dust seeped into the air. He looked up to see a fist-sized piece of rock fall from the tunnel ceiling, dust trailing behind it like a comet's tail. The rock bounced off the wildly shaking floor, settled against the tunnel wall. The entire ceiling gave way. Boulders crashed down. 11:04 a.m. Magma exploded up from the shaft floor, a great gushing pillar of molten rock jetting against the tunnel ceiling more than 2,000 feet above. There it licked against an artificial sun which sputtered once and then fell dark. A great rain of magma sprayed across the cavern, rained down to splash into the hellish pool of bubbling, liquefied hull. Confused silverbugs scattered everywhere, rushing pell-mell in all directions. Some scampered headlong into the boiling pools and melted in a fraction of a second. Some scattered up the walls, only to be peeled off by the torrential cascade of scorching lava. Some fell motionless where they stood, internal mechanics baked to death in heat rivaling that at the Earth's center. Swirling magma covered the ancient tile floor, forming a hell-spawned lake that rose slowly up the cavern walls. Boiling rock poured like water, flowing into the countless tunnels connected, splashing orange hot and destroying everything in its path. The dense mass cavern trembled, a slight shake at first, then harder, then rattling as if held by the fist of a planet-sized giant. The floor cracked and jumped, torn apart by billions of tons of settling rock. The ceiling collapsed, dropping boulders the size of city blocks into the soupy mix of melted ship and liquid rock. The orb's burst of energy created a void that nature had to fill. The mountain slowly fell in on itself as the column of magma continued to jet upward, pushed by the pressures of the world itself. 11:05 a.m. The Land Rover rocked wildly on its shocks, bouncing like some child's toy as the ground shook and rumbled. He leaned heavily against the hood, trying to keep his balance on a jumping trampoline made of rock and dirt. The world shuddered. The ground lurched. He wondered if the sky itself might fall. Sonny McGinnis had never known fear this profound, this all-encompassing. He was down at the base of the mountain, but would that matter? Everything threw itself back and forth so violently, the entire state might be breaking up. And yet, he knew this place of death was, itself, dying, and that knowledge electrified his soul, filled him with joy beyond measure. He raised a gnarled fist, shook it at the towering mountain.
"Now it's your funeral, you son of a bitch!"
The peak seemed to fold in on itself, a massive circus tent with the center stake kicked out. Unfathomable mounds of rock dropped backward out of sight. The mountain started collapsing. It was impossible for the ground on which he stood to move this much, to kick like a mule, to lift the Land Rover and drop it down over and over. Sonny held on against the shockwaves, transfixed as the cursed place tore itself apart. He held on tight, stared up the path that led to the mesa. If he saw the woman, he'd get in and drive off, earthquake or no earthquake, but he couldn't leave, not just yet, because Sonny McGinnis wanted to watch a mountain die. 11:06 a.m. For millennia, the big river had flowed down through the wide tunnel. Now water boiled away as magma flowed into it, flowed up, pushed higher by immeasurable pressure. Liquid rock shot into the kidney-shaped cavern, pushing a wall of superheated steam ahead of it. Roctopi died, but a little slower than their brethren in the ship and at the waterfall. These Roctopi had time to feel the temperature spiking. They had time to scream. Some even had time to flee. Lava flowed across the fields, wiping out crops in a hiss of smoke. The orange mass flowed into the village, swelling up and over buildings. It flowed inside, submerging dead and dying children. And with those deaths, the last of the Utah tribe vanished forever. 11:07 a.m. Pure darkness. He wasn't hot anymore. Cold, actually, his hands and feet growing numb with chill. Connell coughed, blood in his mouth and on the rock pressing down on his chest, pinning him. Pain everywhere. He was made of the stuff, yet it seemed distant, as if it were a photo, a memory. Couldn't move his arms or legs, so much weight on him, trapping him like an insect kept in place by long pins stabbed through limbs and into wax. Cold body. But the air in his mouth, his lungs, that felt hot. His mask had either come off or was broken. He didn't know which. It didn't matter. He tried to breathe deep, but the weight on his chest kept him to a shallow sucking, to tiny, rapid gasps. It was over. No one left to rescue him. No hope of rescuing himself. He was dying. What would it be like? Kind of sucked, really. He should have died in a car accident so many years ago. He'd wandered through life, awash in selfish misery, spreading that misery to others. And here, miles below ground, when dying would have been the easiest thing to do, he'd rediscovered the primitive need to go on. It would have been better to die when he didn't want to live. Cold all over now. The ground trembled beneath him. The boulders on his chest pressing down, settling, making each breath a tiny bit shallower than the one before. A faint light flashed through the cracks between the boulders that were his tomb. Librand or O'Doyle, please. No. He'd given his own life so that those two could escape. Please, don't let them come back for me. Too late for me. The light flashing brighter. Was it Roctopi? Maybe death by blade would be better than this slow, exhausting suffocation, better than lungs compressed until they could draw air no more. No. That light, no reds or oranges, blues or greens, just white. And then a voice. Connell? He knew that voice. A voice from his past, from his dreams. A voice that could not be. He started to speak, coughed blood again. He spat out a mouthful, drew a shallow breath. Just enough to say one word.
Corey?
Yes, my love. I'm here with you. Don't be afraid.
Blackness. Then the light again. He could smell her. Was this a vision? Was this real? He didn't care. Corey was with him again. Her light filled him, erasing his agony, relaxing his devastated body. He felt something warm and tender gently lift his crushed hand. He instantly recognized her touch. He didn't mind the pain, as long as he could feel her again. Connell's hand slowly grew cold in hers, and with a tiny smile on his face, his half-lidded eyes faded away into a blank stare of stillness and peace. 11:09 a.m. Bertha and Patrick stumbled out of the tunnel mouth and onto a small mesa. They clung to each other, had to stay standing upright on stone that bucked beneath them. A cliff, a sheer drop. Was there any way down? Yes, there, between those boulders. A path. A grinding rumble, louder than anything she'd heard in war. It froze her in place, her and Patrick both. The mountain, rising up at a slope behind them. Several hundred feet up the rise, the rock simply fell away. A towering sandcastle undercut by the coming tide. 100 feet of stone. Gone. Then another 100, crumbling back out of sight. Bertha couldn't move. She clung to Patrick, tried to stay standing as the universe trembled and lurched. More mountain above them, falling back, the slope vanishing as if some unseen demon was ripping the rock away to get at them. Another grinding crack, and she saw light coming from inside the tunnel. The mountain stilled. No, that wasn't light coming from inside the tunnel. She saw through the tunnel. 50 feet in, the descending Linus Highway ended, opened to daylight, to air. And past that new, crumbling edge, she could see down into a void that moments ago had been an immortal mountain.
"Sweet Mother of God," Patrick said.
In that void, boiling magma, orange and yellow and white-hot heat blazed with a light of its own, as if the souls of dead Roctopi had flowed together, merged, become a titan ghost rising up to take revenge. Lava swirled, a typhoon of molten rock, bubbles the size of garbage trucks rising and bursting, throwing death into the air. The very center of that hellish whirlpool lifted, became a glowing dome that lasted all of a second or two, then the top ripped open and a jet of magma tore apart the afternoon sky. Bertha watched, hypnotized, unable to move, as a shifting column of molten rock shot 1,000 feet into the air until it could rise no more, until it spread, the spray arcing, then began to rain back down. Back down. She grabbed Patrick, drag-shoved him toward the mesa's edge. He needed no such urging. Together, their burns and cuts and breaks and bruises forgotten, they sprinted down the path as lava bombs crashed around them. The mountain began to shudder anew. 11:10 a.m.
"Well, I'll be dipped in pig shit."
The trembling had died down enough for Sonny to stand without bracing himself on the Land Rover. He'd started for the driver's door, then stopped, remembering his quiet promise to Kirkland. Sonny had raised his binoculars for one final look. Coming down the side of the mountain, or what used to be a mountain, he saw two figures in yellow cool suits rushing along the very same path he'd taken to reach that mesa where Samuel Anderson, Douglas Nadia, and Wilford Igo Jr. had seen daylight for the last time. Sonny had laughed at Funeral Mountain's death, but it wasn't over. Magma sprayed high into the air, higher than any skyscraper he'd ever seen. The flickering tongue of the devil licking out to suck down souls. Huge, snaking globs of half-cooled molten rock arced down, exploding like shrapnel bombs when they landed. Whoever those two survivors were, they had no chance. Sonny needed to get in that Land Rover and drive the fuck off, away from the new volcano and its 1,000-foot spire of lava, not toward it. Sonny adjusted the binocs, focused in on the two survivors. A man, the big security chief, O'Doyle, and a woman, Bertha Librand? Even at this distance, he could see they were in bad shape, limping more than running, faces fixed with grim determination and also etched with fear. God, but they were a mess. O'Doyle fell, landed hard, rolled for a bit before he stopped. The woman knelt by him. A magma glob hit close by. She shielded his body with her own. So goddamn brave. Sonny lowered the binoculars. Could he get to them in time?
"Don't you want to know? Don't you?"
He sighed.
"Well, fuck it. You only live once."
He gave his bracelet a quick rub, thumb tracing the swastika. Then he scrambled into the driver's seat. 11:11 a.m.
Get the fuck up, you asshole!
She kept pulling on his arm, yanking, but he refused to rise. Artillery raining down around them, each impact launching a horizontal spray of black shards and burning rock. So close to escape, and they were going to die here?
Get up! Get up!
She stepped back, and she kicked him right in the ribs.
Get up! Get up! Get up!
She kicked him again. He caught the foot, lifted hard. She stumbled back, fell herself. The ground shuddered beneath her, so strong it was all she could do to get on her hands and knees and stay there. A crack splash beside her, spots of fire on her face, her chest. Bertha rolled to her side, beat at her burning skin. She smelled her own cooking flesh. Big hands on her shoulders, yanking her to her feet. Patrick, no more words, just movement. A boulder smashed into the path in front of her, only a few feet away from crushing her to a pulp. She and Patrick skidded, let the rock bounce on down the path, then they followed it. Lava splashing down around them, killing rocks flying through the air. The two soldiers searched for and found that last bit of primitive need. They ran downhill. 11:13 a.m. A rock the size of a boot smacked into the windshield, turning the glass into a web of cracks. Still embedded there, the rock was surrounded by a corona of the sun's light, fractured into a million tiny rainbows.
Son of a bitch!
Sonny lowered the window, reached a hand down to brace himself on the outside of the door, leaned out. Up ahead, Librand and O'Doyle. A crunch on the hood, hot splatters kicking all over. Something burned his cheek. He slapped it away, leaned out the window again. The Land Rover hit a rock, lurched upward. The door drove hard into his armpit, made him bite his tongue. Blood in his mouth, but he wasn't stopping. The geyser of magma continued to spray into the air, only not as high now. Volcanic bombs crashed down, as did rocks that hit and bounced. A building-sized chunk of rock slammed down, point first, embedded into the trail with a thunderous shudder, and stuck there like the spear of a stone giant. Sonny wheeled hard right off the path. Rocks dug into the Rover's undercarriage, threw the vehicle left and right, but he kept on. He passed the stone spearhead, corrected. The Land Rover caught air as he drove it back onto the path and continued uphill. 11:14 a.m.
I don't fucking believe it, Patrick said. Sonny McGinnis to the rescue?
He saw the little man's body half hanging out the driver's side window, black skin framed by the blazing white beard. The old man was screaming. He was laughing. Patrick jerked his left leg, shook it, a sudden reaction to burning pain. Ash poured down. The end of the volcano or just the beginning? He looked up. The Land Rover skidded to a halt, not even 10 feet away. Bertha ran for the front passenger seat. Patrick opened the rear driver's side door, fell in more than climbed in, heard the door shut behind him.
Hold tight,
Sonny said. Things got blurry. Patrick couldn't see that well. All the damage catching up with him, trying to drag him under. Plinking sounds like hail hitting the Land Rover. Lurching forward, then sideways, then pressed hard against the seat cushion, the car spinning. Impact from below. He was thrown into the air, so high he hit the roof, then fell back down, off the cushion, onto the floor. Librand screaming,
"Drive, goddammit, drive!"
Sonny laughing, a cackle straight out of a bad movie. Bouncing, rocking, thrown about in the tight space, unable to brace himself. Then, speed.
"Patrick, are you all right?"
He loved that woman, but damn if that wasn't the stupidest question he'd ever heard. All right? Hell no. He'd seen enough men die in his day to know he might only be minutes from joining them. But he pushed himself off the floor, the last of what little strength he had, shifting his body back onto the seat. She was next to him in an instant, pressing against him. Together, Patrick and Bertha looked out the Land Rover's rear window. There, a new volcano bellowed a column of thick ash into a darkening sky. The mountain that had vanished was already growing again. What had once been limestone and granite was now the dark black of volcanic rock, a darkness streaked with steaming, snaking trails of rocktopi orange. Patrick could barely move, but he managed to lift his left hand up to the window. He made a fist, then extended his middle finger.
"Fuck you,"
he said. Librand collapsed against him, chest heaving. She nuzzled her head into his neck. Sonny McGinnis just kept on laughing. Epilogue. 5 weeks later. Patrick finished his story. Bertha quickly added a few details that Patrick had forgotten, or maybe didn't want to remember. When she finished talking, they both looked to the old woman sitting behind the desk in front of them, waited for her to speak. Barbara Yakeley said nothing. She looked off, as if trying to process the insane tale she'd just been told. The eyes behind her glasses were red and swollen, puffy bags beneath them hanging darkly. She'd held a burning cigar the entire time Patrick and Bertha had been there, yet hadn't taken a single puff. Patrick glanced at the framed pictures on the wall. A man in a suit and tie, the typical painted image of a company founder. Next to that painting, another. A younger man who was the spitting image of the first. And finally, a painting of Connell Kirkland. Dead eyes stared out. Suit and tie, of course. Patrick wondered if, after all they'd been through, Connell would have preferred to instead be immortalized in a cool suit and holding a weapon. When Yakeley finally spoke, her voice sounded like gravel mixed with heartbreak.
So, these things, they killed my Connell?
My Connell. Much more than a boss-employee relationship there. Not surprising considering the picture on the wall, its place of honor alongside one man Patrick assumed to be Barbara's husband and another he assumed to be her son.
Yes, ma'am,
he said.
They were responsible for his death, although, as I told you, he sacrificed himself to save Bertha and me.
The old woman lifted the cigar, finally put it in her mouth. She tapped it a few times with her teeth, lowered it without taking a puff.
This story sounds like science fiction bullshit,
she said.
How convenient. There's no evidence of any kind. No way to find any evidence either, other than your face and her missing fingers, no offense.
Bertha bristled, but Patrick gently put a hand on her back.
I wasn't exactly a male model before this shit happened,
he said.
All the burns didn't help. Thanks for noticing. Our story does sound like bullshit, no argument there. But we didn't make up a new volcano. You've seen the news coverage, the pictures. And what's more, you strike me as the kind of person who can spot bullshit a mile away. Tell me, do you think I'm lying?
She stared at him, stared hard. He held her gaze, calmly waiting. She would either believe him or she wouldn't, and either way, it didn't matter. Patrick was honoring his friend by telling the story to perhaps the only person who had cared about him. And, hopefully, honoring him one more way as well.
No,
the old woman said. She set the cigar in an ashtray, rubbed at her eyes.
No, I think you're telling the truth.
Yakeley picked up a folder from her desk, a folder that Patrick had provided. No tablet, no computer file, just good old-fashioned paper.
You sure?
She said.
You sure he couldn't have made it out alive?
Bertha nodded.
Yes, ma'am. No one was behind us, and there was only one way out. The mountain collapsed. If that didn't kill him, the lava would have. He's gone.
Her tone was hard-edged, as usual, but Patrick heard a hint of uncharacteristic softness. Bertha had never liked Connell, still didn't. But she knew what he'd done. For that, Connell Kirkland had earned Bertha Librand's undying respect. Yakeley sniffed.
All right,
she said.
He's gone. And now you want, what, revenge?
Patrick nodded.
That's right.
The old woman leaned across the desk, her eyes bore into him.
But why? Everyone in that camp is dead. You two made it out alive, lucky from the sound of it. Now you want to put yourselves in harm's way again? Why don't you two ride off into the sunset together? If my Connell died so that you can live, why throw that away?
A good question. one Patrick had asked himself a dozen times. One Bertha had asked him 100. Patrick was too old for this shit. He knew that. And when he healed completely, he'd still carry injuries from Funeral Mountain that would pain him for the rest of his life. Slow him, make him feel even older than he already was. Connell had died so that he and Bertha could escape. So, yes, the question, why throw that away? The answer always came back instantly, and it was always the same.
"Because Connell Kirkland was my friend," Patrick said. "He was my friend. He's dead, and someone has to pay."
A spark in those sad old eyes. A connection. In that moment, Patrick knew Yakeley wanted revenge, too. She opened the folder.
"And this Argentina thing, this is how you get your payback?"
"That's right," Patrick said. "If there are any of those creatures left, we're going to wipe them out. They don't belong here, ma'am. We're going to make them extinct."
Yakeley turned a page, read.
"This looks expensive," she said. "Is it dangerous?"
"Very dangerous,"
Bertha said, spitting the words out before Patrick could answer. Bertha didn't want to do the mission. She wanted that same sunset Yakeley had asked about. Patrick wanted it too, but not yet. He would never rest until this was done. Even though Bertha said it was stupid, risky, and a waste of Connell's sacrifice, she wasn't going to let Patrick do it alone. Yakeley closed the folder, set it down.
"I'd have to sell off several assets to fund this," she said. "I'm willing to do that. But you're talking about taking an armed force of mercenaries into Argentina. Last time I checked, that's a sovereign nation. What makes you think the local authorities are going to allow this to happen?"
Patrick unconsciously rubbed his right biceps, massaging the rectangle of skin tattooed a light blue, crossed by a horizontal white stripe with a radiating sun in the middle.
"I've done business there before," he said. "I know what palms to grease."
Yakeley raised the cigar, now half burned away, and finally took a long, slow puff. The end glowed the color of flowing lava. She held the smoke, turned her head, let it out slow.
"A lot of people died at our mine," she said. "Not just Connell. I had to call their families, tell them their husbands, wives, mothers, fathers, sons, and daughters were dead. You know what that's like, Mr. O'Doyle? Do you know how it feels to make those calls?"
He nodded slowly.
"In my younger days, I made those calls myself. More times than I care to remember."
Bertha leaned forward, set her left elbow on the desk. She stretched out her fingers, or at least the two that remained. Nasty lines of stitches covered the two stumps. A tattoo encircled the stump of her ring finger.
"I can't wear a fucking wedding ring because of what happened to me down there. But Patrick and I were just married," she said. "That's his name inked on what's left of my finger. I love him. He's going to do this with or without your support, Mrs. Yakeley. If you fund it properly, he's got a much better chance of coming out alive."
Yakeley looked at the mangled hand, then up at Bertha.
"You're going with him?"
Bertha nodded.
"I won't leave his side."
Yakeley glanced to the wall, to the picture of the company founder. Her eyes softened. She licked her lips.
"I'll pay you not to go," she said in a whisper. "I'll give you $1 million if you leave this madness behind and start your new life together."
Patrick was shaking his head before she even finished her sentence.
"Thank you, ma'am, but we're going," he said. "Nothing can change our minds."
Barbara sighed, wiped at her eyes. She nodded.
"I knew you'd say that. I can see it in you, O'Doyle. Stubborn and idealistic. Two qualities that get people killed. But if you want this, then I want it too. It will take me a while to raise the money."
She wrote a number on a blank piece of paper.
Call this number in the morning. My man Harvey will handle things from here on out. You don't call me. You don't come here. Ever again. None of this can be traced back to Earth Corps. You understand?
Patrick nodded.
Of course, ma'am.
Yakeley waved her cigar hand at the door.
Thank you for the visit, she said.
Patrick and Bertha stood. Like a gentleman, he let his new bride exit first. He stepped out the door, then Yakeley called to him, stopping him.
O'Doyle.
She looked back into the office.
Yes, ma'am.
Yakeley's old hands clenched to fists. The cigar stub in her fingers crumbled, spilling smoking ash onto her desktop. She couldn't put on the brave face any longer. Tears flowed down her cheeks.
I want you to kill them all, she said. Kill every last one of those motherfuckers.
Patrick nodded.
That's what I do.
He and his wife left. Soon, they would have the money they needed. Until then, though, there was still much to do to prepare. Prepare for the trip to where Veronica Reeves had made her name. Prepare for Mount Fitzroy.
That was Earth Corps episode number 41. That was the end of Earth Corps. And wow, this story has been with me for a very, very long, long time. The 14, 15 years since we started the podcast, which is hard to believe, but that is where we are at right now. And I've written a blog post on this, and you guys can Google it if you want. Scott Sigler, Earth Corps. I don't know. I'll put it in the show notes over at scottsigler.com for episode 41. But I started writing this book way, way, way back when. I'm going to guess, somewhere in the 95, 96, 97, somewhere back in that era. So 97, 07, 7, we're talking 20 years this story has been with me. I wrote it. I used to wake up in the morning at probably 7 o'clock or so. I write from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Then I would go to my customer support job with Baseview Products in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I had a great shift. I worked from noon to 7. You got saved an hour on the shift because nobody wanted to work that shift. And then I would usually write at night and then go to bed, wake up and do it the next day. And I had no idea what I was doing. I was not a good writer. And I just kept writing drafts of Infected, drafts of Earth Corps over and over and over again as I slowly got better and would go to the library and do all the research for all the scientific parts of Earth Corps, diving into science encyclopedias and spending hours and hours and all weekends at the library researching, trying to find all of this super cool stuff for Infected, for Earth Corps, for Ancestor. And now you can do all that stuff with a click of a button on your computer. But back then, it was quite a bit of work to research hard science for a story. So over 20 years, this story has been with me. We are heading into the final draft of Mount Fitzroy, and that is going to be out sometime next year in 2020. So we will get to continue the saga of this, but for a lot of the characters that you heard didn't make it, we're all done. And I never get to play with those characters again, unless I do a prequel. But nothing going forward from here. Because in the Siglerverse, dead equals dead. We don't cop out and kill someone to screw with your emotions. And then, oh, look, they're actually still alive. We just don't do that. So Earth Corps is done. These characters are gone. And it really puts a friggin' window on how fast time flies. 20 years has gone by pretty quick. I think the next 20 will go by even quicker. And hopefully in the next 20, I will get to write many, many more books for you. And I will get to spend my Sunday with you. You spend your Sunday with me, whatever day of the week you listen to. If you're still listening to this right now, it means an enormous amount to me that you tune in. Even if you bunch it all up and listen at once, you're still spending your time with me listening to the stories I create for you. It is my reason for being. This is the thing that I do. I like to entertain you. I want to take you out of your life. I want to give you a solid quality story. I want to scare you. I want to keep you on the edge of your seat. I want to make you forget about all your problems for a while I immerse you in the problems of people that don't really exist. It's a blast. I dig it. I am the luckiest man on earth to get to do this every day. I am delighted that you have stayed with us all this time, whether you're a brand new junkie who just discovered Earth Corner and just getting to it, or you've been there since 2005, whether you've been to a Sigler Fest or you haven't, whether you're in the Sigler Junkies Facebook group or you're not, which is a great place to be, whether you have spent time over at scottsigler.com or you have not, all the places that we try and circulate, that we try and spend time with the junkies, with the fans, to let you know we're out here and we appreciate you consuming our stories and buying our books and keeping us in business. To all of you, thank you so much for listening. I appreciate your time. And now, my friends, it is time for us to depart. Say goodnight to the bad guy. Earth Core is finished. This is your future Dark Overlord signing off. We'll be back next week with the Earth Core Q&A episodes and then the Reef after that. And I will talk to you all real soon.
You have been listening to Earth Core, written by Scott Sigler, read by Ray Porter, produced by Steve Rickyberg. Copyright 2017 by Empty Set Entertainment. All rights reserved. Theme music is by the band Amps and Volts.